Hey guys, it's Ryan here again, the producer of Techish. Thanks for joining us again, and welcome if this is your first time. You may have seen the show on Apple Podcasts as it's just been featured for the UK Black History Month. Big shout out to Apple for that. This week we have a highlight episode featuring clips from Michael and Abadesi's interviews with Arlen Hamilton, who is the founder and managing partner of Backstage Capital. Sarah Cooper, a comedian and speaker and author of best-selling book, How to Be Successful Without Hurting Men's Feelings. And Ryan Hoover, founder of Product Hunt and investor at Weekend Fund. Remember, we have the Techish live show on November 14th in London. 40% of the tickets went in 2 days, so make sure you click the Eventbrite link in the description to get your ticket now. We really hope you enjoyed this episode. Join in on the conversation with the hashtag Techish. The following is a clip from Arlen Hamilton talking about why it's so important to add value and invest in people when entering an industry you're trying to change.
Again, being disruptive and looking at venture from a different lens. So the value add was at the time when I had nothing. I had nothing to offer them when it came to like, oh, I can do your spreadsheets and can go out. I offered them perspective. I offered them access. The way I looked at it was, let me, and I cringe at the thought now, but it really is kind of the closest thing I can compare it to at the time. I think about it as being their caddy, because I can, you know, put the grass up in the air and tell them which way the wind is blowing and tell them which club to use because of this and that. And that was what I was offering, was this, like, you are, if you believe me at all, then there's a trend happening and it's going to happen in the future. And I can see it now. Let me navigate that for you. What is the cartography?
You know,
let me navigate that landscape for you even before you know you need to know it. And I offered that to a lot of people, and it wasn't at the time, they just didn't buy it. You know, they just didn't think that that was necessary. Now you fast forward 3-4 years, everybody,
it's hollering at you now.
Not just me, but just in general, everyone knows they need to be thinking about diversity.
So how do we avoid it becoming almost like a momentary trend where it's the hot new thing and then, you know, it just goes by the wind, by the wayside after a couple of years?
Well, I've said, you know, one of the things that I feel I can do and offer today to founders besides capital is the truth.
Yeah.
Or my honesty. Maybe it's not the truth, but it's my
perspective.
It's my perspective and honesty. And I have said in the past that I do think it's going to be this trendy thing to invest in Black and brown founders. It just, as it's been for women, it'll be this trendy thing that does go away. So I think it's important for us, as that's happening, to take full advantage of it, not to be reckless and not to be, you know, just doing whatever you can just to get some money.
Yeah.
But if you're working on something that you're really passionate about, or you're thinking about doing that, to know that that's happening and that that probably will happen. I used to say that Black is the new Bitcoin because I think all of this work that everyone is working on, including Backstage Capital, my fund, I think it's going to lead to a lot of money being spent on Black founders, which is awesome. I think that'll happen between now and middle to end of 2020. And then I think as fast as it came in,
it'll
disappear. And the way that we counter that, one is by knowing it, anticipating it, being aware. The second is by enabling and catalyzing angel investors and VCs who are of color.
Yeah.
So today, we can't wait till it runs out, because then it'll be too late. But as we do that now, so if people look at Backstage Capital and say, oh, I want to do that, great, that's why I'm doing it, great, I want there to be competition. I want there to be dozens of us. So as they do that, and then as we're talking to more of the larger funds, and they're hiring more women now. They're getting it. There was a day like a couple of weeks ago where 4 women were hired as partners or principals at VC funds, including at Backstage, Lolita.
Yeah, yeah.
But 3 others on the same day were announced. that wouldn't have been heard of 2 years ago because you wouldn't have had enough of them to be hired to have an announcement that more than one, it was like, oh, I have to keep up now.
Yeah.
So we keep cultivating, keep nurturing that. Those larger funds absolutely need to, they have to. There's no question. They need to be investing in people and not just in companies. They need to be investing in their people. They need to be investing in their next generation of talent that is writing the checks if they want to be around. There's some people who don't care about being around past 5 years. They just don't care. Yeah, I just think that you, in order for you there to be a solution, you have to admit there's a problem.
Yeah.
And that's just 101, you know.
And is that happening? Are there still a percentage of people that are just like, there's no problem, you know,
we're investing? Oh, sure. There's a percentage, but it's a minority now.
It's getting smaller, you think?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's definitely getting, at least from what I can see, and I get to see a lot of it. And I get to see the Twitter version, and I get to see the real version.
Break that down for us. What does that mean?
The Twitter version is what people need, what VCs and investors need you to think of them.
Yeah.
And then the real version is what's actually happening. Who is actually writing the checks? Who's actually hiring? Who's actually answering requests for things that will move the needle?
Yeah, I get it.
It's a very different landscape behind the scenes. But more and more, those two worlds are matching up because you have more accountability.
And have you seen a shift since you've been in the quote-unquote game? Like, you've seen a shift?
Yeah. I definitely have. When people ask me if I've seen any change, any positive change, you have to know that if I didn't, I wouldn't be able to keep going.
Yeah, real talk.
Because it's very, this is not an easy game, as it were.
But I mean in a sense that, for example, with your work, you might be having an impact.
No,
but in terms of the industry at large.
That's what I mean.
That's what you mean, right?
If I didn't see it at large, I would be very, I'm sure I would be doing something that would be towards entrepreneurs in some way, but it probably would go towards media more.
Yeah.
If I didn't see that actually, oh, wow, like, not just our work, but people are actually, like, guys, like, white men are actually changing their behavior based on what they're understanding. And not all of them, but some of them. And if I, you know, when I see that, I feel hope.
Michael and Abadesi discuss Sarah Cooper's book and discuss how tech has impacted comedy and what it's like being a woman in predominantly male spaces.
So another question I wanted to ask is, how has tech impacted comedy in a sense that, you know, now all I ever hear about is what kind of check is Netflix cutting people and stuff like that? I don't know, like, when you're touring and you're talking to other comedians, is that kind of a conversation that kind of comes out now where everyone's like, we've got to get on the streaming platforms? Like, have you noticed the shift in that direction?
I think, yeah. I mean, it's what's cool about it is it's like it used to be, oh, you got to get on this one late night show.
Yeah.
Now there's 8 late night shows.
Yeah.
And you can do a Netflix hour. You can do a Netflix half hour. You can do a Netflix 15 minutes now. They have 15 minutes special.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah. So there's just so much opportunity. So I think that's great. But everybody's still gunning for those things.
Yeah.
And I think, so tech gives you a lot of opportunity, but there's so many comedians. There's so much comedy. But I think we still have a problem with representation.
Oh, I was going to say, because I would love to see you on Netflix. I mean, the most ethnic woman they've got is like Cobra. I didn't finish watching it. You know who I mean. Ali Cobra.
There we go. I was going to. Right.
You know, she's pregnant. I mean, it was good.
Oh, yeah,
whatever.
There we go.
Ali Wong.
What was it called now?
I think the name of the special has Cobra in it, but it sounds like you're a huge fan. Sounds like you are a big fan of her.
We're going to blame that on the British Wi-Fi. Just like, you know,
all
it wasn't
I'm
helping us.
All I'm saying is, like, when I think of my favorite shows, I'm like, Insecure, Atlanta, just like rolls off the tongue. What do they have in common? There are characters I can identify with.
Yeah.
And the soundtrack's buying in.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, Netflix needs
huge
to do
fan
better.
Of Insecure.
So good.
I think my favorite thing about it is that it's so unapologetically black. It's like, no, we're not going to have just like 2 black people and everybody else is white. It's like, no, every single person and main person that you're going to care about in this show is black. And
I love that. You know, we don't have anything like that in the UK. We don't have like any all black cast, all black shows that are on like big channels.
Yeah, it's trash.
I mean, Idris Elba had like a sitcom on Sky.
That's why all the British actors are here. Like, and our people started to hate on them. They're like, why are all the black British actors taking all the roles? Like, it's like, well,
British actors are way better than American actors. You think so?
You're the first person like that I've heard on the stateside to actually like not acknowledge that. Or I don't think it's the case. I don't know if it's the case, but to actually make that point. Most people are like, well, we're just as good here. And like, it's an element of like classism, because they'll always say like, oh, the British actors have training. They went to, you know, theatre or whatever, right? And I don't necessarily know how true that is. Is there a differentiation in a talent? Or is it just...
Well, I think the problem with America...
Yeah.
Yeah.
...is celebrity.
Cool.
So I think in the UK, you see theatre as a craft, a thing that you can do and pursue. And it's almost, it just feels pure. It's almost like comedy in New York versus comedy in LA. Like comedians in LA, a lot of them just want to be actors and they're using comedy as a stepping stone. Whereas in New York, people just want to be comedians. Yeah. Like they study comedy and they want to like be stand-up comedians, and that's what they want to do. And I feel like, I don't want to say like pedigree. Yeah. I don't know what the word is, but
craft.
Like, yeah, it's a craft of just, and hundreds of years. I mean, Shakespeare, I mean, like, it's just hundreds of years, thousands of years, whatever it is. I don't know history.
It's 500 something plus.
Yeah, something like that. But I just feel like they study it and they think it's in itself is something that's good to pursue versus like it's a stepping stone to fame and celebrity.
That's a really interesting insight. I hadn't really considered that.
Yeah, I don't know what the future holds though, because there's a new Harriet Tubman film coming out, and they hired a British Nigerian actress from over here, and I was just on the Twitter sphere
Scarlett
like
Johansson was busy.
Yeah, basically, right.
Oh, gosh.
She's trying to take her job now. Yeah, what are you trying to do? Come on.
She's inspiring me.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. So yeah, so people like there was a few like diaspora wars. People like, oh, like come on, man, like why couldn't we find your like. They already had a British guy doing Martin Luther King in Selma. Like, what's going on? So I'm just trying to see like what's happening here, but.
I struggle with that a lot because on the one hand, I'm like, yes, we should have people playing these characters that come from that background.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's acting. So, like, shouldn't you be able to take on these roles? And one thing I loved about Hamilton was, like, the casting is all crazy. It's all over the place. Mm. That's not what those people look like.
Mm.
But I just thought it was, I don't know. So I get confused about that topic.
Yeah, I'm split down the middle. How do you feel, Abba? Do you?
I haven't really formulated an opinion on it. I don't care.
Like, you don't really mind.
I don't think I care. I think the race thing upsets me and the colorism element upsets me. Like, I do get upset when light-skinned actresses take on the characters of like darker-skinned women because
Zoe
I
Saldana
think we really need to address that.
In the Nina Simone like biopic, they had to like they basically blacked her up. Like, it was kind of really strange.
Yeah.
I don't know what they were thinking, to be honest.
So I feel like when people with more privilege take away opportunities from people with less privilege,
maybe
then
that's the
an
difference
issue.
With Hamilton is that it actually gave roles to people
yes.
who wouldn't have normally gotten those roles.
Exactly, yeah. Which is why I like it. Your blog, if you haven't checked out her blog, please do. It's hilarious. I also send them to my other like women colleagues because we are a minority in our organization, and like a lot of the things that you joke about like literally happen every day.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the things that I feel that we only notice and like in solidarity like share with each other, and the guys are like, oh, what? Do you find that, let's say, an audience with like more women in it
mm-hmm.
is like more responsive just because they like get it, and like there's still a few guys who kind of get a bit defensive when you kind of maybe are like,
oh. There's some of that. I mean, I've already gotten hate mail from just the title of the book.
Wow.
The book's not even out yet.
The title's hilarious.
Wow.
Yeah. So hate mail on the title.
Yeah.
That just shows why the book needs to happen.
It's going
to
sell though.
Yeah,
controversy
right.
sells.
Right,
you must have been like, yes.
No, at first I was like, oh no, it's beginning. It's starting. This was like months ago. And I was like, it's not even, you know, being promoted yet. But, so there's some of that. And I, the 9 non-threatening leadership strategies for women, which is the post that the book is based on.
Yes.
Somebody told me that, like a senior male person at a company shared that with a bunch of women in a Slack as like real advice.
Oh my God.
And that right scared the hell out of me.
No.
Because like, I really want people to know that this is a joke and
wow.
that it's not real advice very, very much. Like with 100 tricks to appear smart in meetings, I was like, okay, if you want to take it as real advice, fine, whatever. You're just going to look kind of stupid. But this, I'm like, no, this is
That's
very
terrifying.
Much like, don't do these things. And I want women to be who they are no matter what, and I don't want them to change how they talk in order to like appease people. And so I mean, it definitely people get the joke and some people don't get the joke, and that's just going
to
happen.
What's so funny though is because, you know, I've always watched comedy growing up, and I've also had to like watch people say things like women comedians aren't funny and stuff like that. And because we live in patriarchy, we basically have to learn how to like laugh at ourselves and like take abuse all the time and kind of like normalize it and laugh it off. And you kind of play to that in this blog post, you know, how to respond to sexual harassment and sexist remarks in a non-threatening way, laugh it off as opposed to confronting it. And I've certainly found that as well. Like, let's say I go do a talk about like my career experiences. The first few times I ever spoke, I spoke to groups of women, and like, everyone would like laugh or like nod or be like, yeah. And then I remember doing like one really popular talk that I do about, finding your true motivations at work at a Google campus event, which was like 80% guys. And like all of the points when people would normally like laugh were just like two or three giggles. Like guys just looking quizzically at each other like, I don't get what she's talking about.
Oh, okay.
Well, here's the other thing with women, which take it or leave it, but like we also... will pretend to laugh at things that aren't that funny, like what you were basically just saying.
Yeah, my girlfriend, she does that a lot for me.
For you?
Yeah.
Men, even with other men, they don't want anyone to think that they're funny. Yeah. So that they hold in their laughter a lot. Like I went to an open mic the other day, and like it was so obvious that the guy in the audience thought the guy on stage was funny, but he was like holding it back.
What?
Like he didn't want to give him the pleasure of thinking that he was funny.
Oh my God, that's so sad.
That's ridiculous. No, that is the definition of toxic masculinity.
Women want men to think that they're funny. So if you make a joke, even if it's not that funny, I'm gonna kind of laugh at it. And I feel like that also leads to the perception that men think they're really funny when actually we're faking it a lot of the time.
Just another thing we have to take for your egos.
Yeah.
That's so interesting because I remember being at Edinburgh Festival once. I don't know if you've done that yet.
No, I want to.
Okay, great. Yeah. As soon as you do, let us know because I'll be there.
Yeah.
And there was this like comedian that we saw, and like no one was laughing. And it was just like this really weird kind of physical humor thing. And I felt so sorry for him. I just started laughing. And then my friend was like, that's so obviously a pity laugh. Like, that's actually worse.
Don't patronize him, basically.
But I was just like, I just can't. So you're so right. It was like my empathy bells were just ringing. Yep. And I was like, I have to laugh. Like, this is like a car crash. So I can totally so relate to that.
Yeah.
The founder of Product Hunt, Ryan Hoover, gets into how identifying a community can help you start a company. His opinion on bootstrapping versus venture capital funding, and what he would do if he had to start from scratch.
So I have this small thesis, because I look at Product Hunt, what you guys are doing, Indie Hackers and Nomad List, and I have this thesis that anything that could be a well-run Facebook group could be technically spun out into a product, not necessarily one that could be monetizable. Mm-hmm. I don't know, what do you think about that? Because I've tried to do something similar with People of Color in Tech, and I've seen people that have got Facebook groups, and I'm like, this could be spun out. I don't know, what's your thoughts on that?
I think that's a really good observation. I think you can actually start building a product or even a company on a Facebook group, just like an email list.
Yeah.
Facebook group is very similar.
Yeah.
And it's probably not where you want to stay forever.
Yeah.
But it's a good place to start to build community and gather feedback.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the most successful products are really community-based in nature. At least they start off very much that way.
Mm.
Like Facebook itself was for Harvard students. And that's a very, very small percentage of the people in the world. Now it's used by, 2 billion monthly or something?
Yeah.
They've achieved and expanded so much that they now need to give internet access to other areas to grow their user base. Like, that's the challenge that they've
reached. We've spoken about that before as well.
It's kind of insane. And so, I think identifying a community of people who have a particular interest or background or passion and then just focusing entirely on that. You mentioned Nomad List.
Yeah.
Peter Lovell's... efforts. He's been working on that for years now, and he's just focusing on nomads. Mm. And that's a niche that you could see also growing in the future, but that's like a very specific type of group of people.
Yeah.
He's not building for travelers, which is everyone pretty much, almost everyone. He's building for like nomads and people that identify with that.
Yeah.
So. That actually like makes me think about this whole theme of communities, because we've spoken about this before, like particularly in the context of like, let's say, like furthering your career and like how you can tap into a specific community to find the right mentors and find the right network. But we've also talked about it in terms of like how opinion is like polarized in society, like whether it's like political views or whatever, and how, you know, going into a social media network like Twitter and spending all your time there, you might end up in like a kind of echo chamber because you're always like following the same people or whatever. And I just wonder, like, now that you've kind of become a community expert, like how do you see communities evolving? Because there are some people within the tech space that feel that micro communities is the future. So you've spoken about nomads, but people think it's going to get even more specific and even more like dispersed. So I wonder what your views are on that.
Yeah, I think some shower thoughts. I think one thing about the internet is it allows people to find people who are like them and people who have the same passions, maybe weird passions or niches. Whereas before, you didn't really have a place to talk about your underwater basket weaving hobbies. Like now you can find a subreddit for that and other communities. And kind of to what you were mentioning before, there's now an opportunity to identify that community on Reddit or Facebook and other places and then maybe build something specifically for that community or that audience. So I think finding a niche that is underserved is actually really a smart way to approach community building.
Okay.
But at the same time, you should also probably be building for people who are, I don't want to use the wrong word, but in some ways like yourself, or rather I should not be building a community for people of color probably. Mm. Like maybe I should partner with someone who can really empathize and understands that community better than myself.
Yeah.
But you should probably be building for something that you identify with or something that you have a expertise or passion around.
Scratch your own itch basically, right?
Yeah. I think that's a good way of starting. Now, then you also need to be aware, and Ab has helped a lot with this, in you don't want to only build for that audience. So if Harvard students, let's go back to Facebook.
Mm.
If Zuckerberg was only building for Harvard students or even just college students, Facebook would be very different than what it is now.
Yeah.
So getting people around the table and being thoughtful in how you build the community to expand beyond that initial niche, I think is really important.
I want to know actually, what are your thoughts on bootstrapping versus getting funded? So Product Hunt is funded, but obviously, you know, you have bootstrapped founders on your platform, and maybe you're trying to encourage them, I don't know, to post. So what are your thoughts? Do you think, obviously you've gone down the road that you've gone down, how do you see a dichotomy? Like, how do you feel about it?
Yeah, so again, Product Hunt was a side project in the beginning. And then once it started getting traction and I realized I want to do this for maybe a decade plus, then the question was, well, I need people to help me. So then you sort of naturally think through, okay, how do I get people to help me? Well, they probably need to get paid
because
people have bills. And I don't have a lot of money. So how can I do that? Well, one is you raise money. And of course, you need to have confidence that this is a venture scalable company that you can actually build this into something that can return money to investors. But the actual reason why we raised money was really to build a team. And without building a team, we would have moved very slow, or maybe we died because we just wouldn't have had the capital to pay people.
Yeah.
So to answer that question, I always tell founders when they ask, like, should I raise money? It's like, one, is this a venture scalable business? And that can be a hard thing to answer because some people fool themselves and thinking, okay, well, maybe it'll expand into like this market. And of course, you're always taking risks when building a company, but you have to try to be honest with yourself. And like, is this something that can become, you know, a $250 million business minimum at that point? And then the other thing is when you do raise money, you can't quit. You can't give the money back. And so I have talked to people who have an idea and it's the first 1 or 2 weeks and they're like, oh, I'm going to raise money for my idea. I'm like, make sure that you know that you want to do this for a decade. I use that as sort of a rule of thumb because if you say 2 or 3 years, that's not long enough. You got to think through like decades.
Yeah.
On the other hand though, I think bootstrap businesses are really attractive in many ways too, because imagine owning 100% of what you built and every dollar that you make goes into your pocket. That's pretty awesome also.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I have the grass is always greener is sort of like this feeling I have sometimes where I think, what if Product Hunt somehow was bootstrapped and somehow, you know, the thing is the reality is I couldn't have built a team, but if somehow it was bootstrapped and we can make all the money and pocket all the money that we made, how would that have changed things? And I think we made the right decision in raising capital and going that direction, but it's not the right, I guess, approach for everyone.
We've spoken in the show before about how, you know, if you are just an ordinary person, not necessarily like deep within tech and startups, you might feel that like a success metric within tech is raising. Because like whenever you read tech news, it's like this company's raised or this company's gone public. And at the same time, you know, you hear about people who've, you know, bootstrapped. We've spoken about companies like Basecamp before and stuff like that. Do you think that maybe the trend is changing and it's like maybe becoming more fashionable to bootstrap, because I do feel that like if you turn only to the media, you'd still very much believe that unless you've managed to raise funding, you know, get that VC backing, you're not as successful as you could be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's people get caught up in what other people think too much, and that can actually go both sides. If we do start seeing this trend where bootstrapping is now the cool thing to do, maybe that's not the right solution or strategy for your company. Maybe if you're, this is an extreme example, if you're Lyft, you need to raise a lot of money and you need to compete against Uber. It's like, it's zero sum game to some extent.
Mm.
And so for some businesses, it's really no option but to raise capital. And so I think in general, you shouldn't worry what other people think and just do what you think's best to build your company.
Case by case basis, basically, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's super subjective. And people get really religious around like anti-VC or pro-VC or whatever. And I think people should just maybe not be so judgmental, but just be more introspective and thoughtful and like, what is the right thing for me to build this vision or this company or this idea out?
Starting from scratch, what would you do today? Is, for example, we mentioned Twitter. Is that still a go-to place, or is it better to go on LinkedIn or Instagram? I mean, I say LinkedIn and I kind of shudder. I don't use LinkedIn, but
like, <"What>
say bye-bye to our LinkedIn sponsorship. Anyway, take the floor.
Yeah. In terms of just how do you break into technology or get started?
Yeah, or even if you're saying, I want to do a startup eventually, but I want to work for a little while. So let me build up my network. Let me meet investors. Let me talk to and engage with other potential engineers that might work for me in the future.
Yeah. My advice has always been, and this podcast may be a good illustration of it, is to focus on something you're passionate about and build some sort of value for a community of people.
Mm.
And that could be in the form of blogging or writing. I did a ton of writing like prior 2 years before Product Hunt started.
Mm.
And it could be podcasting. It could be organizing events. It could be brunches with other people in technology. Really, there's infinite number of things that you could do, but they're all focused. My advice was to focus on that. How do you create value, but do it in some sort of scalable way?
Mm.
Because you can only do so many coffee meetings. You can only meet so many people.
Yeah.
And if you can start to create value for an audience in scale, like something that can reach hundreds or thousands of people for every time you do it once, that's one way to build a reputation and also build kind of a more bigger understanding of this audience or this group of people that you're trying to target. There was a blog post I wrote about, I was actually using Casey Neistat as an example, in that he, you know, he's now extremely popular. And before that, he just spent years and years like focusing on his craft and building an audience.
Mm.
And that audience then segued and followed him as he started building Beam Out. And, you know, he wouldn't have been able to probably raise money or get any traction with Beam if he didn't spend all that time prior building sort of a relationship through YouTube, largely through videos in advance of that. So I don't know. I think I would, if I was someone and if I was 18 and I want to break into tech, I would think a lot about that and just trying to also understand like, what am I passionate about? What do I want to be good at too? Mm. Like, what is my craft? Is it engineering? Is it product? Is it marketing?
I have like a follow-up question to that. So something that I get asked a lot, and I'm curious how you worked on this, is how do you basically like develop your confidence? Because to start out with something like that, you really have to like put yourself out there. Yeah, like you've got to be active. Yeah. You've got to kind of speak to strangers, people you don't know. So yeah, like how have you, you know, from when you first started to now, been able to kind of like build up your confidence and like your ability to just connect with people in a way that doesn't feel awkward or scary?
Yeah. So I'm an introvert, and I've also, I don't think I had much confidence actually in many aspects of my career, partly because I didn't know what I wanted to do and I didn't feel like I was ever qualified to be an expert in anything. And I still actually hate the word expert because it puts anyone on that kind of like on a pedestal. Like, yeah. I don't want to put a target on my back by calling myself an expert.
You got this prediction wrong or something like that.
Yeah, like, I'm not an expert.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of it is you have to just realize that most people feel that way, but also be humble. I think the people who try to sound like experts when they really don't know what they're talking about come off as disingenuous and someone that you maybe don't want to trust or hang out with. So I think it's a combination of humility, but also just being okay with not being perfect or I don't know.
Okay. Do you have mentors? And if so, how did you get them and how do you work with them?
Yeah, I do, but I don't, I wouldn't I don't have like a list of, of either you're my five mentors and you call every
round table that you meet every 2 weeks.
Every 2 weeks do one-on-one. I think there's I have a variety of different mentors in different forms that sort of organically happen. And I think the organic mentorship is the way most good mentorship kind of experiences happen. I've had people cold email me and say, hey, Ryan, can you be my mentor?
And Lord, we've talked about like the etiquette of how do you get them. Even I said that I hate the word mentor because I think essentially what you're looking for is some kind of like loose friendship where somebody can give you advice as a friend.
Yeah.
And using the word mentor, it kind of makes it so artificial and like, I don't know. So, and I said that if someone comes to you and says, can I be your mentor? It's almost like a red flag where you're like, it's too much time investment. I don't have time for this. Like, that's going straight in the junk box or maybe like a no.
And I think the people who do it well, who do want to create some sort of relationship or mentorship, they usually help in some way. They really know what you need help with, or they know you really well. And it can be really light things. Like, I think when I was blogging a lot, I was also, and still am, on Twitter all the time. I was reading a lot of people who were writing in technology, and every time I would read a post, I would also share it and tag the author and include some. It was never just the title and the link, because I felt like I was almost like a robot.
Yeah.
It was oftentimes a title link, but then a statement or something about that
some
post.
Insight. Yeah.
And that was a small thing to, and the reason why I tagged the author is one, frankly, just to put my face in their feed is one. Two, to illustrate that I actually read their post, that I was listening to it. Maybe I added some point to the conversation. And then three, as you do that over years, you start to sort of build these light touch points so that when I do email that person, I'm not just in random person.
Cold, right?
Hope you enjoyed that episode and got a lot from that. Remember to join in on the conversation as #techish. Review this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you hear this. 5 stars, please. And remember, we've got the live show. So that's TechEdge Live Show, November 14th in London. The Eventbrite link is in the bio, so make sure you get your tickets now. Follow Abadesi and Michael Behane. Check the show notes for more. Peace.